Okay, so welcome everyone to the compiler construction lecture. We have started with declaration use analysis last time, and what I've kept from you at the end of last lecture was some practical stuff that I wanted to amuse you with. So here we go now at the beginning of today's lecture. So this is about a topic that is coming in the next chapter about the type check algorithm. And before we can do that, we still need to somehow set up the infrastructure so that types are correctly prepared in terms of marking each of the tokens with their respective ID and all such. So if you live in a world of a well-defined language, let's say something like C-sharp or Java, then you have somewhat nice grammars and language specification. Everything is fine. However, there's still languages out there like C that have a kind of a rugged past in the sense that they have not been defined on the whiteboard, but rather came to life just by joining features and features and features over time without some clear language design behind. And the idea of providing a thing like grammar and lexical specification and almost language specification was rather late, and thus didn't have any concept of automatic generation of compilers in mind. So you come to a situation where you can, for example, buy a book on the ANSI C grammar, for example, and then hope to be able to set up a compiler system. And it turns out that everything looks quite nice, and the grammar that you see in there also is a fine grammar that you can just parse with LL1 or LR1, until at some point you realize that in the specification of the language there's a little star pointing you to some annotation that says, well, we assume that it's, that an identifier that has been mentioned after something like a type def, like in here, so there's a type def and an according identifier here, and the semantics would be that with such a declaration you would introduce a new type named point underscore t that would from now on serve as a type word. So the lexical pattern of that thing is still the same. However, up till that very point, it has to be delivered as an identifier, and from there on, it has to be delivered as a type token, similar to an int or a long or something like that. So there is a change in the token identity that is triggered by the particular declaration for which you actually have to parse that declaration, because what you can mention in there is something quite complicated and can even have opening and closing brackets in between. Thus, is not particularly regular anymore in its form. What also makes this thing particularly ugly is that it can happen within scopes. So this nature of point T having to be delivered as a token of kind type can at some point be closed together with its surrounding scope, and from then on you still have to deliver it as an identifier again. So this is a particularly nasty construction that makes the actual correct parsing of the grammar a matter of being able to parse context-sensitive grammars, which is, yeah, well, a thing that is out of every scope of what we have seen so far, just because there's this one particular pattern in there. So what can you do in situations like these? Well, first of all, you might even wonder whether that is an actual problem, but imagine a piece of code like this one here. That is that is what you would have to deal with. So this is an example input that would show up such a thing. And let's imagine that you take out your strongest weapon in your arsenal that you have at your disposal, which would be something like an LR, let's say, 1 parser, and try to do something about this grammar and try to parse it. Then you have an underlying grammar that you can read off from your freshly bought ANSI C book, and you can read off something like this part for the declaration part of the C grammar, where you have this declaration specifiers, which is the stuff before, and then the actual declarator that would then be the identifier down there. So much, so good. This all you can just hack into your grammar and then put a generator around that. And usually what you would get with that is that you get the chance to register your callback for a particular reduction. So you would put callback code, for example, over here, and you could say, well, nobody forces me to have a pure function here. I could just have a side effect like, well, straightforward idea would be to keep some kind of data structure around that would tell us about whether a particular identifier is now to be interpreted as an as a type name instead of a raw identifier as it had been before. So this is a thing that looks quite nice in the on the outside and would seem to work quite well until you come again to such an example as the one before, where you have such an identifier like a pointee directly following the declaration of pointee. What happens in a parser engine like LR1 would be that in order to actually decide about reducing here, this would potentially at least read the next token from the lexical engine. The lexical engine, in order to do a lookup of the look ahead symbol. So you need to read one token further than, or at least one token further than the position at which you want to reduce at that point. This means that the lexer will have to decide upon point T to either go into the class of identifiers or the class of type names. In principle, with a specification like this one, you would like point T to go into the class of type names. However, you have not done the reduction of this typedef grammar part. This typedef rule is not reduced until the next symbol is, or the next terminal is read as a look ahead. So you haven't registered point T as a new type name yet. So what you will get is that you will have to read in this thing already, and in context of point T appearing here, you would have wrongly interpreted this point T, and you will get a thing like identifier in the next line, which is, well, I don't know what that gives you, but for sure not what you wanted before. So yeah, the problem here is that the parser adds this thing to the table of types when the declaration is used. However, the parser has already read the next token or at least the next token by the time that this declaration is reduced. And point two will be interpreted as an identifier. So this is a quite bad thing because that means, well, what could you possibly do? Could try to fix the look ahead inside the parser with an automatically generated parser? How would you even do that? Have a transition at a, to change the topmost state of the stack somehow? I don't know how viable that really is, particularly since you have based your decision of doing the reduction already on the wrongly classified token. So don't ask me how to do this one. The next one would be to, well, just discard the idea of having the type name separated from the identifiers at all and just add a rule to your parser that would say, well, type names are essentially identifiers. So let's just add something like this. If you do that, well, I've already highlighted you what happens here. Shift reduce and reduce reduce conflicts, and it's not just one shift reduce or reduce reduce conflict, but well, I don't know. I think the parser generator that I have stops reporting conflicts after 100, and I think this is the case that happened for the example that I had here. So, yeah, I don't even know whether these conflicts are just things that you can try to patch manually with precedence clauses, but I highly suspect that the things that you produce there are due to the conflicts that you produce there are due to actual ambiguities in the grammar that you introduce. So, well, no matter what you do, you don't have a chance with this one. So, what can you actually really do for such a thing? Well, you can still find a hack by registering this type name a little bit earlier and do a particular rule for the type def production that does this registration. What you can do as a trick in these LR parsers is you can register an action to trigger in the middle of such a of such a right-hand side. How do you do that? Well, these things usually then introduce artificial non-terminals that expand to just epsilon and register callback for these things to reduce. So that is the way that you can include arbitrary callbacks into your parser generator. And this then is the place where you would register the name as a type name, so that the next input symbol would then be just one that is actually harmless. This one doesn't depend on identifiers or type names at all. This is a fixed semicolon thing, so there's no change in the actual look-ahead interpretation, and there's also no other variant out there with which you could continue this thing, so this is actually safe. But well, still, this might not be the most beautiful solution that is out there. But, well, just to show you, this is kind of the trash that you have to deal with when you go into practical examples. And this is why you get a lot of toy examples in the slides that we have. So, yeah. Anyway, maybe let's go over to the actual type checking now that we have had a few insights into the practical hazards of trying to identify identifiers. So, type checking. What we had before was this declaration use analysis with setting up everything that we need in order to check whether the way that we have set up our expressions really makes sense, and the usual way to do that is to have a concept of types in your language. So what that means is that you usually have one way or another to attach some kind of type to names in those typical imperative or object-oriented languages. So types of of variables and expressions can be different things. It can be just simple types like int. We can have pointers like this void pointer thing, or even compound state types like these struct things that have inner fields that again have types. So this is arbitrarily complicated. What you use them usually for is to at some point reserve memory space for the for storing the variable's values somewhere in memory, be it on stack or heap, doesn't matter. You need at some point to allocate space for that. And the other thing is, well, you usually want to have your support your programmer as much as possible in order to come up with with correct programs. Thus, you would like to remove as many calls for runtime errors as you can. And one way to do so is to talk about the type of values in terms of restricting the values that can occur at certain things. And if you miss specify your program, you could for example have a value that is out of the range of a particular variable end up at an assignment's right hand side, and thus you would have a runtime error. And with types you can try to circumvent that to a certain degree. So yeah, get rid of runtime errors is the second goal for that. So in the imperative and object-oriented programming languages, you usually have the declaration as a way of specifying the type. And all the compiler then does is to check whether the specification that you have written down actually is correct with respect to the types that you have given there. There's also functional languages out there that usually don't have type declarations, but instead you just start using your types, and the compiler has to make sure that the context in which these variables are used that somehow contributes to the type that can end up living to the value that can end up living in that particular variable, that this makes sense and fits together, and this then is type inference. But for our for our chapter here, we just look at type checking. So in order to do type checking, there is the concept of type expressions in order to talk about the constraints on the values of certain variables. And this can be considered to be values for type variables, for example, in that sense. So this with these type expressions, we can generate different types. And the way that you can set this up is that you have particular base types that themselves already serve as complete types, like int or character, void or float or whatever you would have as these single base type words. And of course, there's also in this C world, we've seen that there's also the other things like the type def provided type names that would also to some degree consist as single type specifications, as just atoms in that world. The other part is the type constructors that serve for assembling composed types. And this can be in our world now things like structures, where you have the structure constructor that starts with a keyword and then has different accessors, A1 to AK, which all of them have types T1 to TK. So this is one type constructor. The next one is the one that constructs pointer type. So with that, you just write a star at the end of the type. Then there's the array constructor that consists in these square brackets. And in terms of declarations, you would have the variable name in between the type and the square brackets. Also, you might find some languages where you can have sizes of arrays specified in between the square brackets. And then there's the functions that also form a type and usually provide return type together with parameter types t1 to tk. Again, the variable to be declared is written between the t and the parameters. In ML, you would have that as an uninterrupted string like this one here, with t1 to tk maps to t in that sense. So these are the type constructors that you can have. And I find those, if you are not so familiar with C, sometimes a little bit scary. So what I usually like to point out then is a few people have seen me do that for virtual machines already, I think. So yeah, let's have a look at that. There's always this cdecl thing. That is a small command line program. I don't know. Can I know? Is it somehow? I think I can't really make it particularly larger in terms of font. Can you read that? Not particularly well, I guess. I think this one I can really magnify. Yeah. So this doesn't go into the recording, but it doesn't matter anyway. So if you have problems with associating these types, you can always have this, what is it? Sorry. You can have this, this. You see, there's a line that says, explain gibberish to me. And you can, for example, have an arbitrary declaration like this and have it given back as plain English language, and you can have arbitrary complicated expressions. And have them read out to you in the sense that that it makes it more clear to you. So this is a thing that I would highly recommend if you don't really deal well with C-like type declarations. So yeah. Okay. So let's maybe continue with that. So the problem of type checking is that we are given the environment of the current to be interpreted expression in form of some collection of types and names that are associated with that. And this is this is what we have collected so far as the visible bindings. And what we usually want to know is whether an expression E can be given a particular type, and maybe even how this type looks like. And an example would be, for example, this one here, where we have an environment that looks like this, where we have the identifier list and F and B and A be defined in that way. And you might now realize why I have given you the hint with the cdecl thing. And the question is now, given an expression statement like this one, is this well-typed, what is the type of such a thing, and, well, how would you usually do something like that? The idea is, in general, to come up with some kind of hierarchic structure of the expression. So first of all, you have to set up some syntax tree, in that sense, of the expression, and then traverse this syntax tree bottom up, because usually for the leaves in such a thing, you can pretty quickly say what the type looks like by either having it directly annotated in there, for example, for constants like this 2, or the other case where you have an identifier as the leaf, you can then look it up in the according environment for the whole thing, and then just take the type that is stored at the declaration for that thing. So, and if you then continue your bottom-up visit through the syntax tree of such an expression, you would then propagate the type expressions that you have associated with each of the nodes up to the parents, and then deduce for these parents' nodes new types based on the types of the children, following particular typing rules. And along the way, if it turns out there are certain constraints that are imposed by one type or another, whether this constraint actually holds or not. By the way, how do I obtain the type for this one? Just to wake you up a little bit. So the part that I'd like to hear was the one that this is actually a structure access. So this C thing is not a direct thing that you look up in the generic type environment, but this belongs to actually a particular struct, since this is an accessor in there. So you have to look up what the underlying struct is. In that sense, the node itself doesn't really have a type. It's still part of the operator of looking up. But the outcome of that thing, together with this lookup thing, then obtains a type. But the C itself is not to be confused with the actual variables A, F, and B that are there. As soon as the C appears in context of such a as the right child of such a point operator, then it is to be interpreted as an accessor and thus gets its type from the underlying struct. Okay. Good. So, how do these type rules actually look like? Usually we have the environment in form of this gamma thing, and then some kind of expression for which we can deduce out of this gamma environment that its type is T. So, what are the axioms of that thing? We said that this is usually the usually we get our basic information from the leaves, and in terms of sub-expressions, what are sub-expressions that don't have any further precondition? This would be, for example, the constants. The constants, we said, are predetermined by their own identity, what kind of type these can be, and these are usually these types are usually already determined when you do the scanning of the input. So if you find a particular lexical pattern, you already classify that to be of a particular token class, and this already pretty much determines what type this thing is. So if you have lexical pattern of an integer number, which is just a sequence of digits, then you would usually classify that as integer. So this is a thing that is pre-given usually by the underlying scanner and can just be assumed to be there for each of these constant things. The other thing that is contributing to the axioms is the other leaf in our world, which is the variable. And for variables, we said we can just look up the type in the environment. That's why we carry around this gamma so much. So, yeah, this is how we obtain the type for the variable. So these are the easy cases to determine types for expressions. Now, how can we come up with types for composed type expressions based on the types for their children's types? This is where we set up a system of rules, typing rules, that helps us in that respect. So this is usually given as a collection of type rules that look like, that look like this. They have a name, and they have a certain precondition part that is at the top, and a certain deduced fact that is at the bottom. And in our case, for this ref thingy here, the ref consists in a typing rule that that describes how the types for the address of operator works. So in order to determine the type for the address of operator of a particular subtype E in the context of the type environment gamma, we assume that to be the type T pointer if the sub-expression E in context of the type environment gamma has yielded type T. So if E types to T, then address of E types to pointer to T. That is the way that you have to read that. Okay? And likewise, you can set up such a typing rule for the dereferentiation. So if you have the dereferentiation operator in front of an expression E, and expression E is associated with a type T pointer, then dereferentiation of E has type T. So always you can always derive a certain type from a particular precondition in that sense. And there's even more rules for all the different expressions that there are. There are the ones that deal with array expressions. They usually consist of the indexed access in E1 by the index E2. And this is usually associated with a type T if the E1, that is here in the first position, evaluate types to type pointer to T, and E2 types to an integer type. So this, in that sense, has a fixed precondition that the type for E2 needs to be integer. The other possible deduction that you can have is, well, E2 still needs to type as an integer, but E1 can also alternatively type as an array type. Then it's also legal to have E1 with E2 as an index to be interpreted as of type T. So the important thing is that the base type of this array needs to be the same as the return type. For struct access, the interesting part is this one here, with AI being the accessor into the struct expression E. And this is of type TI if E types as a struct that has a particular accessor that is called AI. And if this AI then has the type TI, then the type of this accessor thing is also TI. Then there's function application. So for calling a function of expression E with the parameters E1 to EM, the type of that is determined by, well, you have to look up what the type of the function's expression itself is. So E and this usually has the same type as this thing over here. So the return type of the function here needs to is the one that the whole thing has. But there's also other things. There's types for the parameters E1 to EM, particularly T1 and TM, and each of the types of the parameters needs to match the types of the function's parameters in order for the whole thing to hold. So this gives some kind of particular constraint that you have that has to hold in order for this to be a valid deduction. Then there's the operation of, well, could be plus, minus, whatever arithmetic operation you would have. For this to be typed as T, we need E1 and E2 to be typed similarly. Then there's the explicit cast with some expression E and type T2. And this, well, types to T2 in case that T2 is something that the type T1 of E can be converted to. Or, well, for the purposes of simplification, for the next few slides, this usually, well, at first needs to be identical, and we will then weaken that up for being convertible too. So, well, this is somewhat modular in that sense. So, this is how this rule set looks like. How can we then apply that to do such a type checking thing? Well, intuitively, what we would like to have is some kind of propagation of these things according to the syntax tree of such an expression. And how you can formally do that in a reliable way is that you try to use these deduction clauses such that they do both of these things. First of all, deconstructing the expression into its syntactical structure, and then try to verify that this deduction actually really holds based on the constraints that you have to pass during the thing. So how you do that is usually you take this expression in question and assume that this is a thing that you want to deduce a type for. This type is not yet known, so we leave it as T. For this to hold, we need the outermost expression in terms of syntactical structure in order to know which type deduction we need to apply here. So in that thing, the addition is, in that sense, the sum of these two things is the outermost expression. So this is why we continue with the arithmetic operation as the underlying deduction. And in order to deduce a type for this thing, we need to deduce a type for the right sub-expression, which is this 2 thing, and the left type expression, which is this thing. And well, we for this arithmetic operation, we can check back. All we need to deduce is that all 3 things need the same type. So that's how we set up this thing. 2 needs to have type T, same as the thing from below, and this complicated fellow here also needs to be typed as T. Now we have smaller type expressions, but we still smaller expressions, but still we need to deconstruct them even further. So for this one here, it's pretty easy. This is just a constant. We cannot deconstruct it any further. So we just take this with the according axiom. That was the axiom for constants, and wait for the whole thing to go into deduction phase. This thing is a composed expression. This is particularly this is a dereferentiation operator that is used here. So we can continue this deduction with a smaller expression of that particular form, and this is how the dereferentiation. Well, we'll see how this then works out a little bit later, because we still have type open here. So we then continue with this expression from here over here, and we still have to deconstruct according to its structure. So this is an array access like this, and this is deconstructed into both parts, like the array underneath, as well as the index part over here. And here we get a new constraint into the system. This second precondition means that we have to deduce that this thing is an integer, otherwise this is an error. For the first thing, there's no additional precondition so far, maybe a little bit later on. This thing is luckily an atom there, so we can use an axiom, in this case the variable axiom. This thing is not an atom, it's composed, so we have to deconstruct it with this being an application of a function that can be decomposed into the parameter, which is without the syntactic sugar. It's an access to a struct together with a dereferentiation. And the other part, this is, well, just a variable that we then have to look up a type for. And so we can continue. This thing is terminated, so we have to continue with decomposing this one here, which is shown over here. This is a struct access, so we can continue with the underlying struct expression, which is this one here, and this consists of dereferentiation and then terminates with a variable. So now we have successfully deconstructed everything. Now we can restart the whole thing and start deducing actual types for that by doing the actual deductions. So for this thing here, we have to apply the variable detection, and this means that we have to look up B inside of gamma, and this will yield us the thing that we could just directly look up in this collection of type definitions, which is this complicated fellow here. And now we can propagate that back down to in the direction of the deduction. So this has to go into the dereferentiation rule, and this says that if I deref, then I will take away the pointer type from this type expression. So it goes like this. Then there's the struct axis, where you said that the type of that is just looking up the accessor C in the underlying struct type, and for that, of course, this, the underlying type needs to be a struct type to work. So this would be one constraint that is fulfilled here. So this is a struct type that is nice, and it also has the accessor of C. So again, nice. And if that is the case, then this results in the type of the accessor. And yeah, that's this thing. So this propagates through to into here. And since this is a fixed T, this has also determines what the parameter types should be. So this is why it goes into both of these things. So this is now a new constraint on the type for this thing. We haven't yet found out what the type for this thing is, so we still have to look it up in our type environment for the variable. And, well, what is the type for F? Looks like this. So again, this fits together with a constraint that we have carried over from that thing. So this is another check that has passed here, and in this in the same way, we had to check for the return type to be actually int. So this is another constraint, and yeah, it turns out that this also passes. So this is another check that is passed in this thing here. So we can then continue with the array access, and array access means, oh well, this was the constraint that we had already checked. So now we have to fill in the deduction from this side. This variable, and this is looked up as an as this thing over here, and this has to be of array type, and turns out that this actually really is. So the return type of that is then the one with the array type removed. This is pointed to int then, and this then determines what the expression from over here is typed as. And now we can then continue with deducing, and this will mean that we will then here get a first component for the next constraint check, because this int star will then fill in the constraint for this t. Particularly, dereferencing that will fix that into an int. Now, this needs to be the same as the t from over there, so let's check whether the const's deduced type is also int, and it's a 2, and this is obviously an int, so this is also fulfilled, so the whole thing types as int. So this is what you would, in that sense, have to do. So you deconstruct everything, and then redescend into the composed thing while carrying over the deduced types for each of the parts, and in case that there are certain constraints imposed on the outcome of certain things, you need to check those things depending on each of these rules. And if there is no objection to this particular typing, then you found that the type check passes, and if not, you have pinpointed the actual location where this thing was violating type safety. So yeah, that is what you would do for type checking particular expressions that you find. So this is already one part of what your typing phase would do. So this can be done in a run over the syntax tree in L-attributed fashion, carrying over your type environment in form of a syntax table, so that you can then associate each of the variables with their according type. And when you pass these expressions, you would do the type checking along the way. What then is still a little bit left open was this matter of typecasts and types being somewhat compatible to other types. So for now we have said that we would just consider types being compatible to each other if they're really equal, at least for now. We can still extend that a little bit later on. What does it actually mean for two types to be equal? This depends a little bit on the specification of your language. In our example of C language, we would, in order for two types to be considered equal, well, we would have to compare the type's structure for component-wise equality until we meet things like structs. For structs, we have the type equality, at least in C, being defined in a very particular way. For example, the one over here where we have struct A and struct B, although that in structure they would be exactly the same, C types would still be considered to be different for both of them since they are named differently. So that is how type equality in C is handled. This is due to a few specialities that you can do within C, like this extension of structs with each other. But I don't want to dive too deep into that. It's just you have to register that as kind of a peculiarity, maybe at that level for types. Then there's this other situation of type depths. And in type depths, C would consider this C and int in that context to be equal afterwards. So type depths create aliasing on types in that sense. Of course, this is very C-specific, but there's a few other languages out there that have a little bit of different understanding of type equality. Particularly, they wouldn't let themselves be fooled by just names, but instead would consider type equality a little bit different from what C does. Particularly, they would consider two types to be semantically equal if they just accept the same sets of access paths. What does that mean? Well, you could, for example, consider these following two structure definitions, still keeping to the C way of defining structs, although the notion of equality now is non-standard C, but instead something different. But to keep us from introducing another syntax here, we still use the C way of defining structs. So this is one struct that offers a field named info and another field in the form of a pointer to the structure itself. It's called next. And let's consider the other structure over there that also has the info field. So this thing in that sense. is an accessor that both of these structures do share in that sense. And what they get back is, in both cases, the same base type for both of these accessors. So what else is there? Then there is the another accessor, which is next, and it happens to be the way that the accessor is also present over there. So this is, again, the same accessor. And both of them return a pointer to a non-basic type. And non-basic types, in that sense, these structs, are considered, well, possibly semantically equal if they offer the same accessor and thus the same access paths. So do they? Well, we can then check. Whatever comes back from dereferencing this next thing is, again, an accessor info. And here, the type that comes back is, again, the same type. So this has also an accessor info together with a base type int. And whatever comes back from accessing next from this next thing is this is again a structure of list one, which is so far pretty similar to what the way that this list thing has offered its accessors. And you could recurse into this thing deeper and deeper and deeper and would rarely find different accessors. Yes?
Is that really true in any case?
That is a runtime property. That is correct, but that is a runtime property. So you can't. So what?
But it's about claiming that in general equal paths, access paths available. You can't really claim that. You can't just say it's a runtime property if you try to make a general assumption about the structure.
It's. I don't see it particularly handling different. Well, this next thing is a pointer, can also be zero as well as this one, couldn't it?
But then you always have one level and the right one. And the right one, you have always another level and one level one and the left one. You can always say,
but you can do that on both sides, couldn't you?
You can, on the right one, you can say this one pointing to info and then do something with info, and on the right, next and info, and on the right, you can't necessarily do that.
I don't see this directly. So you mean on the left, you can. Mm-hmm.
And on the left side, we can not say we cannot say list pointing to next point dot info because there is no object behind next. But on the right, you can do this.
So this is a list.
Yeah.
Next and then.
Next dot info.
Dot info. Sorry. Dot.
This will eventually fail if next is not this one set.
Mm-hmm.
On the right hand side, it will work.
Why? The next could also be null pointer. What if the next is null? But anyway, what still happens is that this is, in terms of typing, you can find types for these things, for these expressions. For this one, all you have present for this expression is the type information for that thing, and this is in that sense the same that can be typed with a type from the other side.
Nice.
And this null thing, this can I would say it can happen in both. Okay, so that is actually the thing. So you can the question is whether the same set of expressions that you can specify are typable with both of them, then they are in that sense semantically equal. Okay, so how do we do typing like that? Well, what you would do as a first idea maybe is that you would try to formulate or to exhaust all the possible expressions that you can formulate with either type and check whether on the current level of structure of your type you both of the type expressions react similarly, and then obtain sub-expressions that have that are smaller than the original expression and have their own type, and repeat the process of exploring what type expressions you can do on those, and repeat until you reach base types for which you can clearly say whether they are the same or not. Or you reach a situation where you have reached the same two types with which you have begun your comparison. And if you could reach that and haven't encountered any inequality so far, then there's no reason to continue re-exploring these pairs anymore. But you can rely on if those are unequal, then this inequality would pop up at some other exploration of that thing. So, for that, you need some idea of how to explore the type structure of things. So, therefore, you introduce some kind of system of rules for whether two types are actually really equal. And this is what you see here. So, you always have pairs of types that you compare with each other, separated into boxes. And if you have syntactically the same types there, particularly base types, then, well, these are obviously the same, so you can consider those as being actually equal and stop the equality test. In case you have composed types, particularly if they are composed by pointer type, then you can continue your equality test if the other type also is a pointer type by comparing the base types of the pointer to each other. If you encounter as one type a type name that is stems from a type definition, then you continue to compare it to the other type by inlining the underlying type from the type definition. I think that goes pretty easily. A more complex one is the one from structs. If you have struct types, then you have to explore whatever type expression you whatever expression you can build from that. So what you usually do is you compare whether or both of them have the same accessors. If they actually have the same accessors, you continue for each of the accessors there with comparing the respective types that they have. So S1 is compared to T1 in this comparison, and finally, for example, this SM is compared to TM in this comparison. So you decompose your structs, for example. So let's have a look at how this works. You have the type definitions here as examples. So there's one type def of the structure as an A, and the other type def defines this structure as type name B. And they also use these names somewhere in their type expressions. And yeah, this is what we are pre-given as context. And then we might wonder whether whether two type expressions, namely this one and this one, are actually semantically equivalent in the terms of following what possible expressions are typable with these types. So for that, we need to construct a deduction tree with the rules that we have set up before. So we compare the two types like this, and we realize there is one that is a type def type, so we inline its underlying type specification, which would be this thing over here. So this goes right into this one here. And since this is pretty long, I've left out a little bit, but yeah. So this is the first part. Then the next one here on that level, we have to compare two structs with each other. How do we usually do that? We do that by first of all making sure that both of them have the same accessors. So there's info and then there's next. Good so far, but now we have to check whether the underlying types of these accessors are the same. So here there's the accessor info and here's the accessor next, and we have to compare for their respective types. For info, this is pretty good. This is just int and int. This can terminate that branch of the deduction. The other thing gives us two pointer types. And pointer types, we have to dereference. So the underlying types are, this is A, and this is three dots that have been this part here. So this is what we get from that. And in order to compare those, we have to look up what the type definition for A is. Well, not again, because we had B before, but again, we have to do a lookup for those. And, this is this one here. So we inline that over here and continue to compare those with each other. So this is, again, two structs. For structs, we have to make sure that they have the same accessors, and both of them have info, and both of them have next. Info. Info goes here and is defined as an int on both of the structs, so this is fine. Next is defined as pointer to A on this side and pointer to B on this side, so like this, and this is next. Both of them are pointers, that is good, so I can remove the pointer type from there, and then I have A and B. And how do we continue with that? Well, again, I look up something, and this A thing, for example, inlines in there. And here I realize, this thing here is a thing that I have already had beforehand. So this is my original equality query. And I have perfectly exhausted every path that I can go from there. Every path that I would go from now on would still lead into the same things that I have already checked. So there's no need to check any further. There is no way of any conflict in there. So I consider both of them as equal. So this is how you would implement that. I think this is just summing up what we have done in the example anyway. So if there is no deduction rules to apply, this is a situation that we didn't have on the example, then we would bail out with saying, well, equality test fails, this is not equal. And yeah, the yeah, we expand the type definitions, but yeah, again, then later on we deconstruct it again, and still this will not lead to infinitely many combinations of types usually, so this will usually go through. In case an equivalence query appears a second time, well, they're equal by definition. This is what we have seen before. So if you exhaust every path that is there to go, then there's no need to go them again, and we can assume that there's no contradiction, and this whole thing is equal. Yeah. All in all, you might wonder whether this thing terminates, and well, at some point you will have exhausted all the possible pairs of different types that there are, and indeed this just leaves you with finitely many possibilities, and when you have exhausted all of them, then you should have run into this last case at some point, which says that you don't have to evaluate them a second time because they are already considered to be equal. Yeah, with that, termination then works. So for equality of types, this is already quite a lot, but still you could say, well, this is somewhat easy to see. We can now extend that a little bit to the concept of subtypes and go over from a notion of two types being compatible with each other if they're equal, of two types being compatible with each other if they are subtypes. Where did we need this compatibility between types, particularly when we wanted to cast from one to each other? So for casting, we can go over from equal types to subtypes. Now, if we loosen our constraints on this typing test a little bit. So one type can be cast into another, usually when it is a well supertype of a subtype, for example. And yeah, so subtyping, what does that mean in terms of typings in this definition here? So we can declare subtypes with this clause T1 being a subtype of T2, and what does that mean? This is a statement on values of that belong to particular types, particularly that the values of type T1 form a subset of the values of type T2, and T1 is a subtype of T2. Also, the values from type T1 can be converted into values of type T2. So you can assign from type 1 to type 2. The values of type 1 can fulfill all requirements of type T2 in the sense that, for example, applying accessors on structs. If one struct is a subtype of another, then you can still use the same accessor paths for values of type T1 that you had been legal to have been allowed to use on values of type 2. And yeah, when still there's this assignability, values of a subtype are assignable to values of a supertype. As an example, well, for this assignability, you can have declaration of type T1, the variable x and the variable y being of type T2. Then you can assign x to y. And in program language terms, this would be, for example, variable x can be assigned to variable y if x is an integer and y a double, for example. So this is even a little bit more impressive when you then extend this subtype relationship to more complex things, like, for example, types of functions or structs. And yeah, this is already approaching the area of subtyping on classes and objects, for example. So yeah, we can then try to set up a system for subtyping, similar to a system for equality, in a very similar way. So again, we have two elements that we have that we want to compare, this time with subtyping relation. So on the left-hand side, we would have the supposed to be subtype, while on the right-hand side, we would have the supposed to be supertype. So if in terms of a hierarchy between the base types, T is a subtype of T prime, then of course we can say that this holds. This would be, for example, that int is a subtype of double. So T is int, T prime is double, then this would hold. Then in terms of subtyping, what can we say about the pointers? Well, for pointers, we have to look at the base type of the pointer type in order to determine whether they are subtypes of each other. In terms of type depths, it's also the same as for equality. Those are just inlined into the respective defined types. So those are not particularly difficult from the ones that we had for equality. Now we could wonder how this extends to structs. And there we see the first difference. Now we have two structs for a subtype relationship query. And yeah, the big difference that we see here is that in order for subtyping to hold on two struct types, we don't necessarily need to have the same number of accessors anymore. What we have to, or what has to hold, however, is that the subtype struct needs to have at least as many accessors as the supertype struct, because the subtype still needs to fulfill the same roles as the supertype, so it needs to react to the same accessors. So not only it has to offer at least as many accessors as the supertype, but also the ones that are present in the supertype need to be present in the subtype. This is given by these things here. So we need k many children for this subtype rule that correspond exactly to the accessors for the supertype. And we have to do these subtype comparisons on all of these accessors, and all of them need to be present in the accessors of the subtype. Okay. And last but not least, there's the subtyping for function types, and they are particularly nasty. So, yeah, when is one function type a subtype of another function type? Well, pretty easy. You take the return types and have them subtype each other, and then you take the parameter types piece by piece, and all of them have to be subtypes of each other. And particularly, you would have them range from 1 to m for both of these and you need to compare each of these. So it needs to be the same number of parameters, and they have to be subtypes of each other. Let's have a look at examples for that. So this is a struct type, and this is a struct types. So is there any form of subtype relations between those? What would you say? Is the left struct a subtype of the right struct? I see a nod here, so... Oh, man. This direction?
Yes.
How can you say whether... Okay, so this is the one condition that needs to be fulfilled. Yeah, so int is a subtype of float. Okay. Next one. This function, a subtype of this function. Or other way around, maybe the right function, a subtype of the left function. I mean, we have air conditioning in here, so... shouldn't be a matter of temperature, should it? Yes?
I don't think it's in any direction the subtype. Since if you look on the left side, the return type stint would be a subtype of float, but the parameters have to be checked the other way around, then float should be a subtype.
So this is the actual thing here. I of course on purpose did this very quick. So you have to be very precise here if you do this subtyping test for functions. They are nasty because of the way that they treat the ordering in which you have to compare the parameters. In comparison to how you compare the return values. So the return values have to be compared in the same order as the original types. However, the parameters go the other way around. So the parameter type from the second type, from the supposed to be super type, goes into the subtype part, and the other way around for the subtypes parameter. This means that in order to determine whether the whether there is subtyping between these two candidates here, you can start from either end. You can start, for example, from the return types. The return types would indicate that int is a subtype of float. For our purposes. So this would say the left thing is already a candidate for subtyping. Then you continue checking for the parameters. However, the parameters of the first function, or the parameter of the first function, is again a subtype of the second function. This is bad, because in order for the first thing to be a subtype of the second thing, we would need that to be the other way around. So this is neither subtype nor supertype. In that sense, correct. So, well spotted. You have to really be careful about this switching of the ordering of the comparison of the parameters. Since this might be a little bit odd, I've put on the slides again another example of what an actual subtyping of functions look like. So the return type needs to be a subtype, while the parameter type needs to be a supertype. So this int here is a subtype, while the float needs to be a supertype. If that is the case, then there is subtype relation between those two functions, function types. Okay? Good. So this is well, pretty famous thing that has to do with, or well, has certain terms coined for that. So there is the thing that, in order for two function types to be in subtype relations, the return types need to be covariantly typed, while the parameters need to be contravariantly typed. So they have to turn around their subtype relationship in that sense. Why is that? Well, this has to do with the fact that you need to fulfill all the requirements of the supertype as the subtype. So the supertype defines the constraints that on types that have to be kept by the subtype. So the subtype needs to take at least the values as parameter that the supertype has to accept. This means that the parameters need to be in the type hierarchy at least the same type, if not a supertype of the original type. And in terms of what it what this can yield as a return value, well, it needs to be it needs to be able to replace the original function in places where this happens. So it it cannot return more values than the original function, because in order for type checking to still hold, the type checking is done on the original type. So it's not allowed to have a wider range of values as return values. So that's why for the return type, it needs to be a subtype. Okay. So with that, we can then start doing these subtype checks in the same manner as we have done for equality checks. And yeah, so they turn out to be pretty much similar. So there's examples here for type defs for S1 to for S's and RIs. And yeah, well, you can do a subtype test of S1 and R1, for example. And for that, you need to, well, if those are then structs, you have to compare all the possible accessors of whom? Well, of the super, or of the supposed to be super type, meaning the right-hand side type. So this would be the R1. So for that, we have to check for the accessors A and F, because they occur here and here. S1 has an additional accessor F, but since this is the supposed to be subtype, this doesn't matter. This doesn't need to be compared for subtyping to hold. So we just compare for A and F, and well, decomposing the type by its accessors A and F, we get for S1 and R1 for A int and int. This is fine. For F, oh yeah, F is the same, but B would have been more in S1. So sorry, got the wrong column here. B doesn't play a role because this doesn't occur in the supposed to be super type. So bugger that. So we have to decompose by f, and this gives us the types s here, which are both function types, which is already a good thing for comparison. So we can decompose by their return types and parameter types. So return types are covariantly, so s1 and r1 go here. And s1, r1 is the exactly same thing as over here. So we stop analyzing here. Instead, we look at the parameter types, and here S1 goes contravariantly, R1 goes also contravariantly in these spots here. So this would mean that we have to compare R1 and R2. Yes?
I don't see the argument why we have to go, why we can stop at this point. Why is it true that when we have this
It's not true per se. It could still be wrong, but if it is wrong, then it should be uncovered by any of the other paths, because
how do you know we have seen all other paths?
We haven't seen them so far, so it's not true yet, but it doesn't give us additional information to follow this thing. Yeah, because we still haven't finished on this path over here. So
can't say if I find another
equality twice. No. This is not the way that I'm sorry if I made it appear like that. No. it's not per se true, but it's not necessary to follow this particular path. You can close that branch in that sense. So you're right. It's not per se true, but it doesn't give us more insight into the thing. So that's why we terminate there. So. For this one, we have R1 and S1. You might wonder whether this is already a problem that we have R1 and S1 in subtype relation while we started with this one and assumed that they have to be equal. And, well, this can still happen. Subtypes is always with possible equality defined. So if S1 is possibly a subtype of R1 and R1 is a subtype of S1, then they might just be equal and this would still hold. So this is not a problem at first, but however, now we have S1 as the supposed to be supertype, and S1, we remember, has the accessors A, B, and F. So this is A, B, and F. And B is an accessor that R1 also would have to provide for the thing to be equal and does not. So this is now the case where we see that although we had it encountering a second time, it's not correct just because we encountered a second time. But we uncover the error on the open branches at some point. Okay, good. Yeah, so that's an example of a subtype subtyping check to succeed with answer false. As it doesn't fail, but it answers false. And I think there's two other tests that, just follow the same principles. But since we have 5 minutes to four now, I think I have to skip them for now at least and continue next time maybe with these two examples, and then we go over to actual code synthesis. Okay, so thank you for your attention and your questions, and then we'll see us again next week.